It's midsummer, and I want to go north. Somewhere it'll be hard for anyone to find me. Away from the hubbub of signposts, maps, and people. I want the wild. Some edge where daylight stays up late into the night. I want antlers of deer silhouetted against luminous sky. I want wildcats, peat bog, Caledonia forest. I pack my camper van with waterproofs, a notebook, and a battered copy of Ring of Bright Water. Images from Maxwell's classic tale about living with otters has been imprinted in my mind ever since I read it as a child. Never mind the slippery reality it portrays, the spell of its otters took hold of me long ago, and I still long to see one in the wild. After hours of travelling, the dazzle of tarmac and white lines blurs my senses. I pull into a lay-by in the moonscape of Rannoch Muir. The panorama of water, rock and heather seems like a gateway to another world. In this wild expanse of peaks and distances, anything human is dwarfed. The ground reveals half-digested stone remains, hinting at its history of struggle and clearance. A short distance away, pools in the peat create mirages of solid earth where living creatures can be swallowed. Deeper down, older shadows lie hidden. The bog has been nourishing itself for millennia, and beneath the visible surface is the dust of mammoth, elk, wolf, and bear. If I walked away from the metallic road and into the ghostliness of it all, I might easily disappear. Away from the driving seat, I can hear, somewhere high up, a skylark chipping away at higher and higher notes. I step off the grid of the road and move into the live surface of sphagnum moss. Close to, the silent, mottled peat bog comes into focus, forming a mapless forest of colour. Through it all, a vehicle rages by at what seems like a crazy speed, ripping the air with a wake of noise. Soft rush and molinia grass offer resistance against my boots. The air is saturated with scents of animal, peat, and gorse. Each day, this moist ground spawns a million midges. Their intricate mandibles are designed to pierce the skin and suck a meal from any available mammal. Water surfaces sensitive to the slightest touch are sprinkled with minute imprints that could be particles of missile or microfeet and feelers, all ready to lift off. I get back into the van, open the windows, and drive more slowly. Other traffic has dropped away, and the Munros of Westeros rise from the dwindling road. Further on, I enter the slopes and peaks of Torridon. Here, remnants of wildness hit me, where the ribs meet and leave no room to breathe. Still water on the sea loch glimmers with the jagged presence of something immense. In my visitor's guide, I read that Torridon means heather in Gaelic, but it has also been translated as place of transference. In my road-sore and eye-weary state, the word transference sounds as if those who pass through will be subject to some kind of metaphysical change. Towards Gerloch, the earth begins to smooth out into green folds of machar. It rumples into dunes, or crinkles like scaled skin down to the tangle of the intertidal zone. The weave in the border between water and land. The roadmap bears no relation to the waves, salt wind, and ruggedness here, approaching Little Lochbroom. I throw it into the back, cut the engine, and roll as close to the sea as I dare. As I step out, the tang of bladderwrack and kelp fills my nose. High above, peaks form a skyline of names that sound like broken teeth. Bain Jarrack, Anchelloch, Bain Golloch. It feels bizarre to be alone amongst all this magnificence, but at the same time, it's essential. My body is churning with the journey, with the trance of tarmac unspooling into sheep, red deer, tumbling streams. Unable to take it all in, I get back into the van, remove my boots and socks, and stretch out on my bunk. When I try to sleep, surfaces of rock and shivering thrift rise behind my eyelids, as if the landscape is already dreaming of its way into me. I lie listening to the tick of the engine as it cools. And sometime later, my sleep is broken by a new sound. I surface and fumble for my watch. It's broad daylight, but not yet 4 a.m. The air is saturated with the smell of wet seaweed. And there it is again, a cracking sound, magnified by the moisture on the air. I peer out, expecting to see a winged creature, a fisherman, or something with hooves startling away into the mist. I struggle to focus. Then I see it, an otter, 3 or 4 meters away, hunched low on a flat rock. Just over a meter in length, he has the dimensions of a male or dog otter, with a broad, flat head, large back feet, and a long, tapering tail. It's the magnificent ruff of whiskers that surprises me, and the bulk of him, the fur sleek from fishing out on the loch. I am seized with joy. His eyes look through me as if I don't exist. I watch, puffy-eyed, nostrils pressed to the glass as the otter devours his meal. He seems to have tackled the pincers first, which makes sense. Using delicate, webbed fingers that are almost human in their dexterity, he doesn't waste a moment. He holds down his prey and crunches through claws, shell, and flesh. Turning his muzzle up to the sky, he swallows, jaws powerful as a trap, spreading splinters all around. His long body is smooth as a lithe brown muscle. I marvel at his ability to make a meal out of an entire crustacean, as every last piece disappears into the pink of his gullet. As if in an elaborate ritual, the otter begins to preen his wet pelt in preparation for sleep. What was smooth as brown leather has become spiked as a hedgehog, lightening in colour as he dries. he moves to the grass, selects a spot, and rolls sinuously over and over, exposing a silvery throat and milk chocolate beneath to the sky. Supple as rope made out of silk, he nuzzles his flanks, and like a cat he wriggles and rolls in the sun. Then gradually coils himself into a pretzel of fur. I watch the rise and fall of the otter's sleeping form. His pelt has lightened to chestnut brown now he's dry, and he is knotted so tightly that limbs, head, and tail are indistinguishable. Still in last night's clothes, I slip out and try to get a little closer to the curled shape in the grass. My stealthy commando crawl drags in the heather, making what I think is only the subtlest of sounds. The otter seemed deeply asleep, but one ear must have been left on duty, because soon his head rises. Instantly, he's alert. His neck lengthens for a moment, and his head bobs as he makes sense of the threat. I can tell he is very puzzled. Maybe he thinks I'm a bigger otter. From the sniff-level position, I get a flash of the otter's extravagant whiskers, and in a split second, he catches my scent. He turns and makes a direct gallop for the shoreline. He moves quickly, but with the lumbering gait that, I learn later, otters always have on land. His body arches into a small hummock as he runs, but when he disappears back into the water, he does so without a sound. In the stillness of the June dawn, there is hardly a breath of wind, and the last thing I see is the tip of his tail as it's sucked into the glassy sea. The tussock grasses are still, the white tufts of cotton immobile, and the otter dissolved into the water as if he were part of it, his colour and shape sleeking into nothing. The air sifts through the grass. An oyster catcher opens its thin red bill and calls an alarm. A freshwater stream dribbles over pebbles nearby. I can smell sheep fleece, layers of wet peat, and sweet bog myrtle. Tufts of sea pink flutter as if the whole earth is flowing with electric current. I want to go after my otter, but he's already melted away.